From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, DACA.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
Massachusetts lawmakers respond.
This is worse than a broken promise. This is betrayal. It's betrayal of a promise to these young people. It's betrayal of America.
Also, the White House says if Congress doesn't like Trump's decision today, they should change immigration law.
And again, if they can't, then they should get out of the way and let somebody else take their job that can actually get something done.
But Congress hasn't been able to pass immigration reform for years. What makes anyone think they could do it in the next 6 months? We'll ask Massachusetts Rep. Mike Capuano. All that and bridging the gender pay gap. The city of Boston has been sponsoring negotiation workshops for women. Did they work? That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. By now you've heard, 800,000 young people currently under the DACA program could face the risk of deportation next March if Congress does not act to pass some kind of immigration legislation. That's because today, the Trump administration, through Attorney General Jeff Sessions, announced that it's rescinding the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program.
We are people of compassion, and we are people of law. But there is nothing compassionate about the failure to enforce immigration laws. Enforcing the law saves lives, protects communities and taxpayers, and prevents human suffering. Failure to enforce the laws in the past has put our nation at risk of crime, violence, and terrorism.
The choice to rescind DACA drew condemnation from virtually every major Massachusetts elected official. Here's Senator Ed Markey.
This is heartbreaking. It is unjust, and it is just plain evil.
And Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey.
We are going to court to defend DACA and to fight for these dreamers.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh.
Dreamers are every bit American as I am, as anybody in front of me today is. Or these dreamers are as American as Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump.
Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker also said this in a statement. He said, quote, President Trump made the wrong decision today that could negatively impact our economy and many of the Commonwealth's families. That's because there are 8,000 DACA recipients in Massachusetts. The governor also went on to say that he hopes Congress acts quickly to find a bipartisan, permanent solution here. Now, in a moment, we're going to hear from a DACA recipient and from immigration advocates. But first, let's start with Andrew Arthur. He's a resident fellow in law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington. He's a former immigration judge at the York Immigration Court in York, Pennsylvania, and former assistant general counsel and acting chief of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. He's currently a resident fellow, again, as I said, at the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me today.
So first of all, what's your take on today's announcement? Do you think the Trump administration did the right thing?
I don't think that the Attorney General had another option. If you read through Judge Hannon's order in the DAPA case, the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents case, called Texas versus United States, and the subsequent Fifth Circuit decision sustaining Judge Hannon's order, this was unconstitutional activity. This was DACA was an action that the president himself admitted that President Obama admitted he didn't have the authority to do, and it would have been indefensible for the Department of Justice to have attempted to defend it in the face of the threatened lawsuit by state's attorneys general. So, quite frankly, I don't know whether it's a question of right or wrong. I don't know that there was any other choice as a lawyer that Attorney General Sessions could have taken.
So what's the deeper issue here? Is it the constitutionality of the program, or is it the existence of of some sort of protection for these young people? Is it immigration that's the deeper issue here? Because I feel like all day today, both with Attorney General Sessions and with Donald Trump's own, the president's own statement, all these things are being lumped together. So what's really happening?
Well, this was a massive overreach by, again, President Obama didn't have the authority to do it. only Congress has the ability to give immigration benefits to individuals. Flows out of the Constitution. Courts have sustained it for more than 150 years. And what President Obama did just wasn't legal. And the Trump administration was in a situation where they were going to have to either defend it or not. And Attorney General Sessions had his people look at it and decided that they could not defend it. Now, it's interesting that the president has a six-month sunset on this. Individuals whose DACA will expire within the next 6 months will have the opportunity by October the 5th to seek renewal of that, which means that this program could go on for another 2.5 years. It's not like ICE is going out tomorrow and rounding people up, which is an important point to make.
Just on that, though, I mean, I'm seeing BuzzFeed ask the Department of Homeland Security for a statement on what DHS might do if ICE does ask for information, because the DACA recipients had to give all their information to the government. And the DHS sent back a statement saying that they will not proactively provide ICE and Customs and Border Patrol for information about the DACA recipients. But if they ask... if ICE asks for it, they'll give it to them. So,
absolutely. And keep in mind that the individuals who applied for DACA knowing that they were giving the United States government their information. There are certain situations in which, under law, you know, where Congress has stated that information that is provided by applicants for certain forms of relief cannot be used for enforcement purposes, but because President Obama did not go the route of going through Congress and decided to do this unilaterally, that protection wasn't in place. It's also important to remember that in 2010, when Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, when Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker of the House, that Congress was unable to pass the DREAM Act into law. And that's why the president acted that's the reason why the president acted unilaterally in the way that he did.
But it's also, I mean, immigration reform has been a challenge for Congress for years and years. In 2014 or 2013, 2014, same thing happened. I mean, they came close, but that time it was the Republican Party and hardliners in the Republican Party who blocked immigration reform from passing.
Well, it's interesting because, frankly, there really hasn't been substantive immigration enforcement for the last 8 years up until January the 20th.
I'm confused about that, though, because if immigration enforcement, I mean, didn't the Obama administration radically increase deportations, like more deportations than under the Bush administration?
By cooking the books, what they did was they identified individuals who had been apprehended at the border and taken into custody at ICE and then removed individuals that we previously didn't count as deported. That's where the delta took place. But if you look at the number of individuals who were actually removed from the interior of the United States, particularly in the last 4 years of the Obama administration, actually since 2009, it went down. And that includes not just, you know, law-abiding people who are here illegally. That includes criminals as well.
So how does any of that, though, pertain to the 800,000 young people who decided to come out of the shadows, give all their personal information to the government, have to basically adhere to a very, very high standard in order to get the deportation protections from DACA? How does any of these other issues pertain to them and their future in the country?
Well, actually, for what it's worth, I would respectfully disagree with that. They weren't even subjected to the same grounds of inadmissibility that most aliens are. The crimes that they were allowed to commit and still be eligible were less than Section 212 of the INA provides. And quite frankly, they didn't really have to go through any rigorous process other than applying. But here's the bigger issue. President Obama actually spoke prophetically in July of 2010 when he talked about, you know, doing things by executive action. He said he believed that it could lead to a surge in more illegal immigration if he were to do that. And the fact is, that's exactly what we saw. DACA went into effect in June of 2012, and then we saw a massive increase of unaccompanied alien minors, particularly in 2014. at which point we saw 68,500 unaccompanied alien minors show up.
But did that have to do with DACA, though? I mean, the Attorney General said the same thing, but none of those young people were eligible for DACA. They had to be in the country before 2007.
Absolutely. I can tell you as a person with 25 years of experience, and as a person who was sitting on the bench when those people came to the United States, they believed, and quite frankly, the smugglers encouraged this, that the United States was granting permission for individuals to come to the United States. We don't enforce our laws, we make it clear, we send a message that the door is open, and if you just want to come in, you can. And that was reinforced by the Obama administration, John Sandwick, who had been the acting director of ICE, when he said it was, you know, if you come to the United, if all you that you do is come to the United States illegally and you're here illegally, the odds of you getting apprehended are almost zero. Mm.
Let me just ask you one final question here, if I may.
Please.
So the ball is in Congress's court now. There's no question about that. I mean, what would you like to see come out of this? Maybe some specific legislation around the so-called Dreamers, or more comprehensive immigration reform? And if it's the latter, what makes anybody think that that's possible, since we've come through, you know, like a 15-year-long period already where it hasn't been possible?
Well, going back to what I said before, we really haven't seen immigration enforcement in the United States in a number of years. I would even count some of the Bush years in that. The reason, what I would envision is that there will be some sort of benefit that is granted to some or all of these individuals, but there are going to be significant ramifications. Again, whenever you grant amnesty like that, you encourage people to come to the United States illegally, believing that they'll be next. So we do need to see beefed up enforcement. We need to see things like the RAISE Act, which was introduced by Senators Cotton and Perdue, that would put us on a point system, much like Canada and Australia have. We need to see detainers be enforced. We need to see sanctuary cities legislation that makes it clear that there's only one immigration policy in the United States, and that's set by the United States Congress. And most importantly, we need E-Verify mandatory, so that we know that people are coming here to work. I mean, I will tell you that you know that yourself. People come here, almost everybody that stood in my court was looking to come here to make money for the family. If you take away that jobs magnet, which Barbara Jordan said we should do more than 20 years ago, you take away that jobs magnet, they're not going to come, and we will return to the rule of law.
Right. That's something that does deserve further discussion, because right now the tenor of the conversation across the country is the criminalization of the undocumented immigrants, rather than maybe what we can do to change the job market that's attracting them. Andrew Arthur, resident fellow in law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let's listen to what White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders had to say today. She took a question at this afternoon's press conference about whether the president, who had once said soon after his inauguration that he would treat the so-called Dreamers with heart, whether or not he's breaking that promise to the Dreamers.
It's not cold-hearted for the president to uphold the law. We are a nation of law and order. And the day that we start to ignore the fact that we are that, then we throw away everything that gives these people a reason to want to come to our country. If we stop becoming the country that we were envisioned to be, then we throw away what makes us special, which makes America unique.
Well, let's speak to one of the so-called Dreamers who probably is feeling a lot of reaction today. Valeria Dovale is a DACA recipient. She's a sophomore in college and staff member at the Student Immigrant Movement. It's a statewide youth-based immigration advocacy program. Valeria, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Yeah, I mean, you just heard that piece of tape we played from White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who says that she doesn't think that the president's decision today was cold-hearted. Well, what's your reaction to that?
Yes, I also heard the previous gentleman speaking on the issue, and it definitely raises a lot of feelings. But I think what's important to remember is that, and which was also failed to be mentioned by the previous gentleman, is at the end of the day, this was a promise made by the U.S. government, regardless, as a whole, and we did pay for our applications. They were not free. And we did have to gather a lot of information and evidence to submit our applications. And so it's definitely a breach of trust. And, you know, I think that's pretty much what's going on.
Are you worried about your future?
The amount of worry I have for my future has really not changed the past 13 years of my life being here in the United States. It's been pretty consistent. I would say that as a whole for my entire family, I think under this administration specifically, seeing that a great number of people who do have, you know, clean records, who otherwise have been the entire description of what, you know, many folks ask for in terms of people who shouldn't be, quote-unquote, deported. We've seen those people be deported, and so I think that's raising a concern to me more than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
So you were 7 years old when you were brought to the United States.
Yes.
And from Brazil, is that right?
Yes. So I crossed the border at the age of 7 with my mom and my 1-year-old sister.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just you walk a few miles and you're there. It's quite a journey. We had to fly into the capital of Brazil. We had to, you know, take a plane down to Mexico. We had to cross the entire desert and the river. It took several days. In fact, I was separated from my mom and my sister for about 20 days until I was able to reunite with them again.
So, I mean, I guess there's so much politics swirling around this right now.
Right.
How does it feel to you that, I mean, this is, it's your life.
But it is.
But we have, you know, we have thousands, millions of people out there who think that you know, that by rescinding DACA, they're doing something to protect American jobs and the American worker and the American middle class. I mean, what's your response to that when that's what people say, why they support this move?
Yeah, I think that's just misinformation being fed from several directions, really. And it's something that, you know, we can't really get upset about. We have to sit down and talk about it and really address the real issue at hand. And that is that, in reality, we're not having the right conversations. And a lot of times, it begins with the fact that the conversation around immigration is very much talked about in terms of the interior aspect, as the gentleman previously had, you know, mentioned. But in reality, it is an exterior problem as well. We can't pretend like, you know, the United States is a vacuum, a sealed vacuum container. It's not. And so, you know, we are, in many ways, we have a lot of global outreach. And a lot of our politics extend outside of the United States alone. And that is bound to impact other nations. And that is bound to cause certain types of chain reactions, including mass migration, including, you know, these the instances we are seeing right now with refugee cases from across the entire world. You know, so I think that's one of the very first things is the way in which we talk about immigration from only one side.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there are several other things that go into it, you know.
Valeria, can I just jump in here for a second? Because I don't want to run out of too much time with you here.
Of course.
I'm sorry if I already asked you this, but I just want to clearly understand. I mean, are you, based on what the Trump administration announced today, are you concerned at all that, you know, if there's no immigration reform or no congressional action in 6 months, that possibly you could get deported or you'd be facing that risk?
I think so. You know, to be in all honesty, and this is truly how I feel, I think that, you know, we've been asked this question a lot, and I think, you know, people want us to be really afraid right now. And unfortunately, I don't think that's the feeling that most of us are sharing. I've been here for 13 years. You know, 10 out of those 13 years, I was fully undocumented with my family. For 3 years, I had DACA, but I still, you know, my family was under threat of deportation. And so it's not like, you know, our fear of deportation never went away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I've been afraid for 13 years. I have not been afraid just beginning today, you know. And I think that's very, very important for us to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's going to be very important for the following months, you know, to really talk about how much can we put pressure as organizations, as folks who really fight for immigrant rights and who really care about the issue, to address this and to really hold the government accountable for really not, you know, doing their jobs in terms of dealing with immigration and fixing the immigration system.
Well, Valeria, on that point, last question to you is, what is your message now then for members of Congress?
My message is that we're going to be doing our best to really share the true narrative of the immigration system, of what it's like to go through the immigration system from the point that we reach the border, going through ICE, going through everything, going through the checkpoints, all the way to how people have come in here with visas and their visas have been, you know, expired, from people, you know, crossing the border and not going through checkpoints. All the narratives we are going to be talking about with them, we are going to be sharing them, and we're also going to be educating people on the real facts about how people are contributing, how we are not taking people's jobs, how exactly it is that we are not a threat to society.
Well, Valeria Dovale is a DACA recipient. She's a sophomore in college and a staff member at the Student Immigrant Movement. It's a statewide youth-based immigration advocacy organization. Valeria, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Well, we want to get one more voice in here. It's Ava Milona. She's executive director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, co-chair of the Governor's Advisory Council for Refugees and Immigrants. Ava, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, I just want to play another piece of tape from Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his announcement on DACA earlier today. Here's what he said.
The effect of this unilateral executive amnesty, among other things, contributed to a surge of minors at the southern border that yielded terrible humanitarian consequences. It also denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans by allowing those same illegal aliens to take those jobs.
So, Ava, I mean, in that tape you heard Sessions call DACA a unilateral executive amnesty, and he again pointed to an economic argument that many people in the Trump administration, not least the president himself, have been making for quite a long time. I mean, what's your response to that?
But let me first say that our hearts ache for our dreamers today, and I wanted to say that to every DACA beneficiary to know that we stand with you, and we will work relentlessly to ensure that you're safe and have the resources that you need. And to the question, I mean, this action is not legally required. It was simply a political decision. DACA works. The beneficiaries of DACA are employed. They're in school. They're serving in the military. They're paying taxes. They're contributing to our economy. As you heard from Valeria and as we heard from many today, this is the only country that they know. They had no say whatsoever in the decision that their parents made to bring them here. Mm-hmm. They are Americans at heart.
Well,
with the end of DACA, the cost is estimated that 700 jobs will be lost and $2 billion a year revenue.
Mm.
Now, it will force highly productive, skilled workers underground, harming businesses, impoverishing our community. It is a very unwise and a terrible public policy that goes against American values.
So Ava, if I may just jump in here, 700,000 jobs, I believe you meant nationwide, because there's almost 800,000 people in the program. But to your point about who this harms or benefits in America, I mean, in the president's statement, written statement that he put out today, he said, quote, "I do not favor punishing children, most of whom are now adults, for the actions of their parents. But we must also recognize that we are a nation of opportunity because we are a nation of laws."
We are a nation of laws, and Congress has failed to really fix a dysfunctional system. politicians, lawmakers from both parties have worked for a long time to update our dysfunctional and outdated immigration system, and they failed. What President Obama did within his executive powers is providing a temporary fix to give Congress an opportunity to legislatively fix and deal with Dreamers, who many of them have been here since the age of 6 or 7. They are young adults now, part of the workforce. And, you know, what happened today, it's simply a political decision. Mm. As I said, this action is not legally required. The president, it's putting an artificial deadline for Congress to act, and we hope and are hoping that the Congress will act and do the right thing. And also there is an opportunity for President Trump also to do the right thing and make sure that he works with both parties and come up with a solution that really helps the Dreamers.
So Ava, let me ask you, Valeria spoke very bravely about whether she was any more afraid of deportation now than she was, you know, for the past 13 years. But I'm just wondering what you're advising DACA recipients to do. Should they be concerned? Because, I mean, again, today, the USCIS, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, said that they're not going to proactively give immigration or status information to ICE officers. But if ICE does ask for it, they're gonna provide it. And they have all the personal information. They know where all of these 800,000 young people are. I mean, should they be concerned?
800,000 people complied. They came forward. They trusted the government. They gave their information. They got work authorization. They're part of, you know, the workforce. And losing DACA means, A, losing the ability to work, the ability to drive, the ability to have temporary status. And, of course, they should be concerned. All of us are concerned. Under the current administration, there is no priority as to who is deportable. Under the Obama administration, very serious enforcement, but at least there was some priority in terms of who are first to be deported, those to do us harm, and so forth and so on. Now that is a zero tolerance policy. So the concern is real, the concern is present, and MIRA will work to ensure that Dreamers have clear, reliable information to guide their decision making, as well as free legal advice and referrals. We will collaborate with our partners across the Commonwealth to ensure that schools, that colleges, that employers, that cities and towns all have the knowledge and the tools they need to support the young people at this difficult time.
But so, Ava, if I may just jump in here, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you or talk over you, but I'm conscious of the time I have with you. And there's one more question that I want to ask you, because Senators Dick Durbin, Illinois Democrat, and Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, just a couple of minutes ago said that they're calling on both the House and the Senate to vote on the DREAM Act this month. Senator Durbin said to the Dreamers, he said, don't give up hope. But on the other hand, a little earlier today, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, was asked, does the president want some sort of comprehensive immigration bill? Is that what he wants to see the next 6 months? Or would he be willing to sign kind of a DACA-only, Dreamers-only piece of legislation? And Sarah Huckabee Sanders could not or would not answer that question directly. So are you concerned that even though Congress has this six-month period in which to do something, that we may come out the other end of it exactly where we are today, which is with nothing?
We are extremely concerned, and there is evidence there for a long time that the Congress, even though there has been bipartisan support, both parties under the Bush administration, under the Obama administration, wanted to get immigration reform done, and Congress failed and failed again. So the concern is real. The concern is huge. And I hope that, you know, Senator Durbin and others will, and both parties will work together. But the concern is huge. Congress has shown that they failed us many, many times. Mm. But we will not give up and we will not lose hope. We will stand with nearly 8,000 Dreamers in our Commonwealth and 800,000 across the country and our partners to do everything in our power to protect and provide for them and advocate with Congress and reaching out to President Trump and the administration to do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, Ava Malona, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. Ava, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll hear from a member of the Massachusetts Congressional Delegation after the break, so we'll be back with you in 60 seconds. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've been talking about the Trump administration's announcement today of the rescinding of the DACA program. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. It could affect 800,000 young people across the United States and 8,000 people right here in Massachusetts. Now, the president said he's giving Congress a six-month period until March of 2018 to do something about immigration if they don't like this decision to rescind DACA. So let's get a congressional voice in here. Representative Michael Capuano. He represents Massachusetts 7th. Congressman Capuano, it's good to have you back.
Nice to be back.
Do you think Congress can do something in 6 months?
This Congress has not shown any ability to do almost anything. However, I hope so. I mean, a lot of my Republican colleagues say the right thing when it comes to DACA, and they say the right thing about immigration reform. But thus far, they have been the voices that keep losing in their own caucus. I firmly believe that if we could get a reasonable, comprehensive immigration reform bill on the floor, like the ones passed through the Senate, which would include addressing this issue, I think it would pass if it was allowed to have a stand-up vote. The problem comes with the majority party thus far not being willing to even put it on the floor for a vote.
Right. I mean, isn't that kind of what happened last time around, that Congress was close in 2013, 2014?
Yes, that's exactly right. And we couldn't get it on the floor. I mean, people have to understand, the agenda in the House of Representatives is completely controlled by the leadership of the majority party. It's not new. It's always been that way. The only way to avoid that is to get what's called a discharge petition, which requires 218 signatures on the petition, which is a majority of the House. And in this case, it would require us to get about 30 members of the Republican Party to join the Democrats to force the bill to the floor. That might happen, but it seldom happens, because the pressure within each party to not go against its own leadership is very significant. So we'll see. I think this might be a difference. We'll find out.
So let me ask you about that, because today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she gave... Honestly, I thought it was an interesting press conference today, combative not necessarily to the White House press corps she was facing, but combative to Congress, because she was asked, she reiterated the president's position, saying, you know, ball's in Congress's court. And then she was like, hey, if Congress can't do it, get out of the way. But here's what she said.
I think that the American people elected them to do it. And again, if they can't, then they should get out of the way and let somebody else take their job that can actually get something done.
Now, who do you think that message is for? Is it for congressional Democrats? Is it for congressional Republicans? I mean, could that be the lever that sort of gets this process unstuck?
I don't know about that. I mean, so far the Trump administration hasn't shown any ability or willingness to work with Congress, either Democrats or Republicans, but we'll see. That message could only be aimed at the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate. There's nobody else who can control the agenda, or at least to grow a spine for some of the more moderate Republicans who claim they're in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. It couldn't be aimed at the Democrats, because we've been trying to do that for as long as I can remember. The majority of Democrats, the vast majority, there might be a handful, if that. I'm not even sure there are any Democrats who would not vote for comprehensive immigration reform. But we'll see. It could only be aimed at the Republican leadership and the Republican right wing.
Now, let's hypothesize here for a minute, Congressman, if we could. Like, what would a potential immigration compromise look like that could ostensibly pass both the House and Senate?
Well, it would have to include what to do with the 10, 12 million people who are already in the country, including the Dreamers. The Dreamers might be a separate action, but there has to be something done with their parents and people who don't have children in the country as well. Are we really going to let's assume, for the sake of discussion, that we have 12 million people in the country here that are undocumented. And let's assume we have, just round off the numbers, a million Dreamers. So let's just take them out of the equation. That still leaves 11 million people that we have to deal with. most of whom are good, solid people who are just trying to make their lives better. Are we really going to deport 11 million people? I think the answer is no. I think everybody realizes that's the case. That's not what we're going to do. That's not good for the country. It's kind of a silly thing to worry about too much. But we do have to deal with them. We have to either make them or find a way to get them on a path to becoming legal or deport them or whatever we're going to do. And then we have to move forward and say, okay, based on where we are today, maybe we need to look at our immigration reform going forward. How many people do we need in this country next year and the year after and the year after? And what qualifications should they have? This is not easy stuff, but that's comprehensive immigration reform. I think it can be done by thoughtful people who want to find a resolution. It cannot be done if the Republican Party only listens to its extreme right wing, who simply want to just deport everybody and throw up walls and not let anybody ever in again, because that's not how America was built and that's not what America is.
So, Representative, let me ask you about that, because, I mean, yes, from the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, we're getting superheated rhetoric about immigration. Criminality is lumped in, gang violence, all sorts of things. But also, at the same time, they're talking about, in you know, what they see as a fundamental unfairness, not to the immigrant population in the United States, but to Americans, working Americans, who in some sectors, construction, for example, have seen an impact on their wages. And that is the part of this argument that I think receives a great degree of sympathy for folks who are, you know, in the middle of the party.
I don't disagree at all. But again, we're not going to deport 11 million people. That's a great and good and thoughtful argument going forward. I think that part of the weakness on the Democratic side is that we never talk about secure borders. I am for secure borders, not because I want to keep everybody out, but because I want to keep our economy strong, and that requires us to make sure that the labor force is not excessive.
So in that case, if the House put forward a bill that sort of put DACA and immigration reform tied in with building a wall, would you vote for that?
I've always thought the focus on the wall is silly, because a wall is just a symbol. But that, if there are millions of other ways to make the borders secure, and that's fine by me. That don't cost the kind of money they have. I've always thought the wall is a distraction. But I do want secure borders. I want them in the thoughtful way, in the most cost-effective way you can get. And I just don't think a wall is it. But I'm just not worried about that. What I'm worried about is, let's assume you could put a wall on all four sides of America and it'd be 100 feet tall. You're still going to want immigrants to come into this country to do some of the work to help this country expand. And to me, that's the important question.
Yeah.
How many and what qualifications do they have? And for the sake of discussion, based on what you just said, and I'll accept it for the moment, for the purpose of discussion, that the construction industry is one place that we don't need any more people to come in, then we say, okay, fine. If you want to come to this country, you have to have a qualification beyond being a good carpenter. We don't need any carpenters this year. We might next year, but right now we don't. What we need for the sake of discussion is farm workers. We need scientists, whatever it is we need, and let the economists decide who it is that we not you know, the race or the ethnicity, but the qualifications that the individual has coming into this country.
So, Representative, I very much appreciate your candor about where Democrats have dropped the ball on this, because this has been a bipartisan failure for 15 years now, immigration reform. So on that, just last quick question to you. In this moment now, what more should the Democratic Party, should Democrats, leading Democrats, be doing?
I think at the moment, whether we like it or not, the entire agenda is run by the Republican Party. They run the House, the Senate, and the White House. And in this particular case, it pains me to say that I agree with the comments coming out of the White House, that it does fall on the Republican leadership to get this issue on the agenda. Let's have that open and honest debate. Let the votes fall where they may. And I, like everything else, if we could do this, we're not going to get a bill that I'm going to like or that you're going to like, but we can get a bill. It's just like health care. It'll be something. It'll be a step in the right direction. I believe there is a majority of Congress willing to do that if we are allowed to do it.
Michael Capuano, he represents Massachusetts 7th. Congressman, it's always invigorating. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In an effort to close the gender wage gap, or to help close it, the city of Boston has been running free 2-hour salary negotiation workshops for women for the past couple of years. And a new report out today says the workshops seem to be helping. A case study of 52 women who attended the workshop by the Center for Women in Politics and Public Policy at the University of Massachusetts Boston found that nearly half of the women used the skills they learned to negotiate higher pay or a competitive starting salary at a new job. Now, to date, 5,000 women, or nearly 5,000, have taken a workshop, and the city's goal is to train 85,000 women by 2021. That's half of Boston's working women. Now, joining us now is one of the women who participated in the workshop, Ashley Paré. She's also a volunteer facilitator for the program now. Ashley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello, thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Also with us in the studio is Victoria Budson. She's the founding executive director of the Women in Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and she's frequently talked to us about negotiations and the gender wage gap and the working world here. It's good to have you back, Victoria.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so Ashley, first of all, tell us, let's just cut to the chase. Did the workshop help you?
Yes, it did.
How?
I negotiated a new job, a new offer with a new company. So I was able to set a salary range that I was looking for and negotiated back and forth once I got my offer. So I had the courage to ask for more once I received the offer from the company.
Okay, so what did you do this time around that's different than what maybe you had done before, if you've ever had the opportunity to negotiate before? And what was it in the workshops that you really were able to pull to use in this negotiation?
Yeah, I've always negotiated. I don't really know why, where that came from. I just knew I wanted to ask for more. Maybe my corporate HR background gave me the one up there that I knew it was okay to ask. But the workshop really helped me to understand and have the confidence to set a range, to do the research, have data to back my worth in the market based off of the role I was getting the offer for. So it just reaffirmed that the company should be paying me for what the role I was going to be doing there.
So you came to the table with data.
Yes.
Okay. And what about this idea that in sort of presenting their case in a negotiation, that women often don't use the right language or have the right approach? Is that something that the workshops touched on?
Yeah, offering the right language or the options for language to use, that's a lot of fears come up, right? As a facilitator, a lot of women ask about how can we even start this conversation. So the workshops definitely talk about scenarios and give the women options to use different language.
So give me an example.
Maybe
something that you even said in your own negotiation.
Yeah, so if the recruiter asks you right up front, you know, tell me what you're looking for or what are your salary expectations?
$9 million. Sorry, no.
That would be great.
I'm just trying to be bold here. But anyway, go ahead.
So you can start high. That's a strategy. Or you could deflect, right, and let the recruiter know, I'd love to learn more about the opportunity. I need to better assess the job responsibilities and roles before I can come back to you with salary expectations.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so Victoria, let me bring you in here. What is it about that technique, instead of coming back with an answer of saying that I need more information, what is it that makes that effective?
Well, there's a couple different things. So one of the things which Ashley talked about in that deflecting technique is you want to understand where the employer wants to anchor the negotiation before you give an alternative anchor, which, of course, will be higher.
Okay.
And if you, as the prospective employee, anchor it, what if your number is lower than their lowest number? You've just foreclosed on yourself. So that technique that Ashley described helps anchor first the employer number, so then the prospective employee can go up above that.
I see.
Now, there's a second important piece when you discussed what is the right language. Hannah Riley Bowles, who's the research director at our center at Harvard, her work showed that when women negotiate, if they make a direct ask without an external validator, Ashley talked about that she'd done her homework.
Uh-huh.
She would know what that job is worth, so she had a range. And when a prospective employee can use that external anchor, can again say, this is what these jobs are worth in the marketplace, that helps women negotiate without getting social backlash.
So this is really interesting because part of me wants to, I suppose since we're so data-driven here, I can't imagine going into any situation without data, but it's really, salaries are particularly difficult, right? Because there's the whole transparency problem. Like, how can you find the right range when there's so much of the problem that causes the gap to begin with is that we don't know?
Well, that's right. And there's new tools, things like Glassdoor. Okay. The web has made it so you can really find out there information about your area. Plus, with the pay equity law that was passed in Massachusetts a year ago July, that goes into effect July 1, 2018, employees are allowed to now share their salaries as of that July 1 date with no repercussions.
Right, no repercussions. Okay, so that's a major change here. Yeah.
It's a major change, and Ashley could go and ask some of the people in the office she's going to go work in, so how is the pay here? And people could share that information if they chose with no fear of reprisal.
Yeah. So according to the study of the 52 women who are in the case study here, out of the 5,000 who've taken the workshop so far, of those 52 women, 87% researched and identified their appropriate target salary. And 40% of those surveyed actually went ahead and talked with their supervisors, I guess the current supervisors, about their work and value. Now, how big of a hurdle is that to clear, the actually starting the conversation? Ashley, you were going for a new job here, but what about if you're trying to negotiate something within your current employment?
Well, sometimes it's really looking for those opportunities when there's discussion of new job responsibility, when it's one's annual review, when one has just done something fabulous that's been recognized, and then when a woman can build into those other conversations talking about what the role is, what her value is in the organization. And there's two tools that have been very effective for women in particular. If they can continue that relational frame in the dialogue, if Ashley was my boss and I was going in to have a conversation, if I could say, Ashley, I really enjoy the role and working together on this team. When I look outside in the marketplace, as this job has grown, I think the skills that I'm providing and the role look like they would pay about 10% more in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And then even better if I could say, and I have an external offer and I'd really like to stay here. Mm-hmm. I used all relational language. What we see is men, if they just said, Ashley, I think I deserve 10% more. If a man just asks like that, what we don't find in the research is anyone feeling uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But we find if I ask Ashley directly as a female, that I can get into a rub where I seem not as lovely. And women have social backlash for that. We're not saying that's the way the world should be.
Yeah.
But the research shows using those external validators and that relational frame can help women achieve the raise without social backlash.
So I just want to make a point here that obviously we are speaking about women who are in jobs where they have the opportunity to have these conversations about their value, or they have the opportunity to enter into some kind of negotiation. And that, of course, is not every job.
It sure isn't every job. And there's lots of women, particularly in the lower socioeconomic bracket, who are in positions where it's an hourly wage and it's non-negotiable. We often say those positions have sticky floors because rather than hitting a glass ceiling or having negotiation issues, it's hard to move up from those jobs. And often the negotiation they're having is less about salary and more about moving to the next rung in that organization.
Yeah. So, I mean, Ashley, you've now moved to becoming a facilitator for these workshops. Why'd you do that?
Yes. I was inspired in the workshop, and it was an epiphany. I had to do it. I had to share not only my personal story of negotiating throughout my career and the barriers and successes that I had, but also looping in my corporate HR experience. So I wanted to bust myths about how HR and companies think about this process from a recruiting standpoint and from a hiring standpoint.
Okay, so tell us about at least one of those myths that you felt compelled to bust.
So I hear it in all the workshops is that women are afraid that if they negotiate, they'll lose the job offer. So every hand goes up in the workshop that, yes, I'm afraid of that. And then I ask, well, who has that actually happened to? And I've trained hundreds of women now, and very, very few, less than three hands have gone up to say that actually was an outcome. And so there's a fear that you may ask. And from an employer's perspective, if you're going to lose the job because you asked for more, then to me, that's a sign that you're not entering a company that respects its employees. It's a sign of the culture there, and so it's a sign for you to step away anyway.
Hmm. Yeah, so that's really interesting. You know, we just got a minute here to go. The time always goes by so quickly here. But Victoria, there's one thing, and actually, Ashley, if you want to chime in, please, too, that I wanted to ask you about, because You know, here we are, we're talking about negotiation, which is a potent means by which to close or help close a pay gap for individuals. But of course, Victoria, as we've talked about multiple times before, there are still structural issues in the working world that even after successful negotiation, a woman may not end up at the same place as a comparable man would undergoing the same negotiation.
That's right. It's important for everyone to understand that having salary negotiation skills is very important, but it's one piece of a broader mosaic of what will close the wage gap. It takes employers doing internal wage audits to understand whether or not they're paying men and women. It takes ensuring that women have the same access to STEM education and then career fields. It means apprenticeship programs within the trades need to fundamentally include women. Mm. There's lots of different actions. It takes the legislative side. It takes actions from government like Marty Walsh's work with companies and sharing their wage data. All of these pieces will come together to help us close the wage gap here.
Keep going. We'll keep going. Victoria Budson, founding executive director of the Women in Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Ashley Perez, you participated in a workshop in November 2015 and now facilitates. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
This is Radio Boston.